It's Friday. Slow
clock and tubes. Everyone's downloading Borderlands 3.
All right. They use Tailwind on Borderlands, I'm pretty sure.
On the website?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I saw a tweet about it. That's how I know Borderlands 3 was coming out.
It's been all over, all the Reddit ads. And then a friend of mine from high school works for whatever that company is. So I see all the updates from her.
Yeah, I think Evan Yu's been tweeting more recently too about different people, different game studios specifically that make games that he likes that use Vue on their sites. Let me see if I can find a few quick. He tweets about MMA. We have a lot of common, Evan and I. Lots of MMA tweets here. I don't know. I'm not going to go looking for it now. But yeah, that's why I know like more of the newer games coming out, people tweeting about the companies that use technology they like.
That's funny, but not the in-game itself, just the...
Right, just the websites. Website. Just the websites, yeah. Well, what have you been up to? I could talk about business stuff, but I don't want to because I haven't been writing any code. I haven't been able to get off of phone calls in the last few days. So I want to talk about what you've been up to.
That's okay. Business stuff is important. I mean, you wouldn't have a business if you didn't have business stuff.
Yeah, but I'm sick of it.
You'd just be writing code into a vacuum.
I'm sick of business stuff.
I guess that's what open source is.
Yeah.
So a funny thing happened this week. I got a package from Amazon, and big stickers on the outside say, warning, lithium battery inside.
Uh-oh.
And it's friggin' heavy box. I'm like, what the heck did I order? I don't know what this is. And I open it up and it's a battery backup for my computer.
Did you order one?
I'm like, somebody listened to the show a couple weeks ago and sent me a battery backup because I was complaining about the power going off and losing all my work.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So sure enough, Lee, my partner in crime at Remote Ham Radio, sent me a battery backup.
I suppose it benefits him for you to have a battery backup as well.
Yeah, but now the thing is, like, I don't want to shut my computer down and install it because I'm going to lose all my work again.
Oh God. Yeah, I've been trying to think more about that recently, but especially more when I was in Vermont because the wind would blow and the power would go down where I was at, and it was kind of frustrating actually how often it happened. I just didn't ever get around to getting one. Oh my, I'm scrolling through my Elixir Slack unread threads, and here you are talking about Link.
Oh yeah, my like one thing I know about Link, having almost never used it.
Yeah, so for me it was kind of wild because I was like, Ecto is one of a kind, this is so cool. And then you're like, oh yeah, it looks like Link. And I was like, huh? And turns out it's prior artwork, right?
No, I think nothing in Ecto is original, like it's all borrowed ideas from different libraries.
I'm almost certain you're right there. It's like it's a solved problem.
Yeah, but it's probably what makes it unique is the combination of all those ideas brought together. I think
that's a good way to put it. So I guess I can say that I have been reading Programming Ecto, the book Programming Ecto, and I like it quite a bit. So when I first looked at it, the Prague books, they kind of give you like the beginner to advance little diagram there. And it was more towards the beginner side. And I was like, I've been using Ecto for a while. I probably don't need to buy this book. That was a mistake. So I ended up buying it later and I'm learning so much stuff already. I feel like it's really kind of filling in some of the cracks for me. So definitely do buy Programming Ecto if you want to learn more about Ecto or if you use Ecto often. It's just a good read.
Yeah, I think that's pretty insightful because you kind of learn just enough to be able to do your job, right?
Exactly.
But if you go back and read the basics, it's like, oh yeah, there's all this other extra stuff. I mean, not just in Ecto, but just in general. I think I mentioned this before, but probably my best architected Elixir, Phoenix application was actually the first one I wrote. It was a card game, Skip-Bo. I followed all the practices, the modules and gen servers, and like did all like best, recommended way to structure things. And I still haven't even come close to writing anything that's that clean and nice.
I feel my first and current Elixir or Phoenix app is, it's all right. It needs some help, but what app doesn't, I suppose.
Speaking of that.
Oh, here we go.
I have been busy. working on things that I probably maybe don't need to work on right now, but you know, here we are. You'll see why in a second. Mm-hmm. You already know what I've been working on.
I do, yeah.
I think I sent you a curse-filled series of messages on Discord Monday or Tuesday this week about the remote ham radio Rails application.
And it's not the first time you've done that either.
No, it's not. And yeah, man, it's sat there. I was looking through the commit history over the past like year and a half, 2 years, basically unchanged, right? All the innovation and changes and improvements we've done have all been on the front end, right? With Vue.js, and then with the real-time system, all the Phoenix and WebSockets and stuff. And that didn't necessitate any changes on the quote-unquote back end, you know, the Rails, what I call the CRUD application, right? All the plain static pages for dealing with user accounts and, you know, back end stuff, subscriptions, billing, all that stuff has basically been unchanged for quite some time, which is honestly probably fine. You know, it's nice that I don't have to get in there and mess with things because, boy, is it a mess.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those things where if it works, I think one thing that people always point to is like the example of wow, it's just leaving my brain right now on this hot Friday. Steam. The Steam store, right? Like everyone points to how garbage like apparently the code is, and they're still running jQuery and all that stuff. But it's like it's making money. It's sitting there doing what it needs to be doing.
That's funny. I mean, their friends list didn't work for like 5 years.
Oh really? I haven't used it too much, to be honest. But no, that's cool. Yeah, like it sits there and you haven't had to change it in a while. So what's suddenly causing this need to change things up on the CRUD side of things?
I don't even remember what it was I had to work on. I had to go in there to do something, and man, I just hate it. I just dread it every time I have to. Oh yeah, I had to work on some login like credentials stuff.
Oh okay.
Because I was working on because now we have to like you log in on the Nuxt app, which is on a separate domain, and it's also hosted on Netlify, and so it's you can't really like. Getting the logins and logouts synchronized between that and the Rails app is kind of a pain. So I had to do some stuff in there to finagle it to, you know, do the right thing. But yeah, it's just a pile of hacks and like half refactored into Trailblazer paradigm, like a beta version of Trailblazer that is not even close to what it looks like now. Yeah. So I don't even know really where things are depending on what controller I'm trying to work on.
I gotcha. Yeah, that sounds challenging.
And looking at it, and being the fact that we haven't touched it more or less in a year at least, is like, and there's not really that much in there in terms of functionality. It's, you know, some back-end admin CRUD for adding and removing different just tables and regular plain old stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some stuff, there's a whole section of the logger. There's some logic dealing with that. So the logging in terms of not application logging, but ham radio logging your contacts that you make.
Right.
But I've actually written a bunch of that in Elixir already, just never like finished it. So there's a bunch of that I've already sort of done. And and then the billing piece is the other big piece, the synchronization with FreshBooks and invoices and stuff. And I think, you know, do you see where this is going at this point? It's like, it's time to start bringing over a little bit at a time, just like what you did when you were starting at DK,
mm-hmm.
to bring some of the functionality over to the Phoenix application.
Yeah.
It'll rise from the ashes.
Rise from the ashes. Yeah. It worked out well for me. I think really like it's that balance, right? Like there's the old, saying like rebuilding is never the right thing to do or until it is. And then there's a lot of, I guess, stigma around that. But really, I guess at the end of the day, if you're thinking about it, if you can afford the time to stand up something new and replace it like that, and it makes you faster in the aggregate long term, that I think it makes sense.
Yeah, it's really important for us to have everything under one roof. It really simplifies the, you know, deployment process to keeping track of all the issues. And there's actually some things that I literally just can't do right now because there's this disconnect between the Rails app and the Phoenix app. Like something, for example, I would like to do would be like okay, I'm on the back end, right, and I make a change and I hit save, I want to be able to just have that change automatically propagate to the WebSockets.
Right.
The only way I could do that right now is if I had a Redis server in the middle and they're both connected and talking to each other, and I have to make up my own pub sub just to like do something like that. And that is totally not worth it. But if it's all in the same application, I hit save, I blast out a new state to all the things, and then everything is done, right? It's all in the same application. Stuff like that where the integration is, you know, would be hard otherwise.
Right.
That's, I'm really looking forward to being able to, you know, make the change easy, then make the easy change, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's a good way to put it. So it sounds like you've got a start on it already. How are things going?
Yeah, so I posed the question in our Discord, and I kind of already knew the answer, and I knew what you and everyone else was going to say. But I asked it anyways because I wanted to hear it from someone else about, okay, we're bringing this stuff over. And in my mind, there are two options. There's the quote-unquote port option, which is where you keep the same underlying data store, right? Because Phoenix and Rails are already connected to the same physical Postgres database using the same schemas and everything. Mm-hmm. And basically, you just bring over the logic, you know, the application logic, but keep the underlying data store the same. That's what you did with DK, right? You just, all the cruft and all the badly, poorly designed database with typos in it, right? The column names or whatever.
Yeah.
You just brought that over, and then at least you could stand something up. And then you went and did all the refactoring since then, right?
Right, yeah, because otherwise I would have gotten stuck I would have been refactoring an app instead of building an app.
Yeah, that at that point, it's basically a rewrite, right? It's the difference between like porting something and rewriting it from scratch, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good distinction to make, a rewrite versus a port, yeah.
Yeah, so a rewrite, in my mind, shouldn't be, like, you can make a mental note, oh, I need to change this, this, and this, but don't actually do it, mm-hmm. right? Leave little nuggets for yourself, or keep a document somewhere, and just bring it over, warts and all.
Yep, 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 yep.
It's so hard to do that for me mentally. I'm like, oh, this is bad, but it's fine for now. Just shove it down, push it, kick the can down the road. That my other option was like, basically, do a quote unquote rewrite and do a one time like database migration, bring all the data over, and that's scary,
daunting.
There's just too much new stuff there, and it's not really the goal here. At least immediately, it's not like. You know, like you said, it works. Just keep it working, but let's get it all in one place first.
It's such a big change right up front. Just bam, you know, the rewrite plus the data migrate. It's so much stuff. I think that standing something up and doing it one by one is probably the best way to do it. And in fact, when I was starting to do Design Collective, which would have been like 2.5 years ago, maybe now. There were even blog posts then about like how to do it endpoint by endpoint with Phoenix. Because people are already sort of like jumping ship or whatever you want to say it.
I thought about doing that, and I sort of kind of half do it right now where our application is behind an AWS load balancer. And based on the route, you know, the actual URL, I route things differently at the Phoenix app versus the Rails app. Actually, that was one of the first things I put into Phoenix was all these, had a bunch of polling APIs that were just spitting out JSON, and they were mm-hmm. polled frequently. And Phoenix is really good at that. So I just pointed those particular routes at Phoenix just to get that improvement. And in theory, I could, like you said, just bring it over one endpoint at a time. Although, again, you have to think about the authentication piece, how you bring over the user's identity between those domains.
Yeah, that's a big thing to think about for sure. And if I'm remembering correctly, most people, or at least the blog posts that I found, were talking about putting... essentially, what they would do is they would take the Phoenix API or app and they would put it in place of the load balancer. So all traffic goes through the Phoenix, and when there's a route that's not implemented, it actually just forwards that request onto the Rails API and then forwards the response back.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you didn't want to deal with a real load balancer, you could totally do that, and that would be fine.
Right. Yeah. So I thought about doing that too, but what I ended up doing was. Just because we were in a place where we had like a big backlog of things that needed to be done. We certainly had some bugs that needed to be fixed, but also we were barely even live. like the site was barely even live. We didn't really have traffic. So I was in a pretty unique position to be like, all right, we can just blow this thing away and no one's going to care.
Yeah, that was definitely the right choice for that. Especially when it was, the application was small enough that you could do that. It didn't feel small at the time, maybe, but now it certainly is.
No, it did not. Now it seems tiny. Like even though we have a ton of features, but even now it seems like I could actually reduce the code footprint by quite a bit and be totally fine. Really, I think most of the glue is between the business layer and the web layers, between like controllers and Absinthe and stuff. I feel like the business logic stuff isn't that much. It's really not that much.
Yeah, it always feels like that until you start looking at it and you're like, oh,
yeah,
there is kind of some stuff in there.
I just don't like to touch anything about billing in all that. Thank God we store everything, so even down to like what the Stripe fee was on a charges table that's associated with orders, so we can give exact breakdowns to the penny to people that ask for them. I'm glad that that's all done, because we get people that think like, oh, you underpaid me, and then we do the math, I'm like, no, we didn't. so I'm just happy to have all that stuff. But so how are you approaching this? You said you're sort of doing it porting, right? So you're sort of taking the warts and all, and you're basically porting Ruby to Elixir. Are there any like paradigm changes that you're having to embrace, or is it almost fully just like a port?
It's a good question. I think I'm gonna try to keep it as straightforward as possible in terms of the concepts, the way things are organized.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to be too big of a change for the users either, because you know, change is upsetting. I'm basically just gonna go one controller at a time and just try to complete each of those things, each controller or control action sort of individually, and get that feature complete. Literally just like, you know, click testing, comparing, does this, I can just put the two windows up side by side. Does this do this or does it not do it? Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's not going to be whole hog. It's not going to be like, this is going to spend all my time doing this, because I've got plenty of other stuff. You know, I'm still working on the Flex Radio integration. I'm still working on this new Electron app. Those are really the actual priorities right now. This is just going to be like, oh, I've got a couple hours here or there to kill some time, or I just need a break from doing whatever. Just kind of work towards that a little bit at a time.
Right. So you've been sending me these little videos in Discord, and this is what I've really been wanting to talk to you about.
Yes.
So we're a live view show now, and I want to talk about live view.
Yes. This is live view episode 3 of 3.
Yes.
3 of many to come, I guess. Yeah. I thought this would be a good, man, after ElixirConf being so hyped up about live view, talking about it with you, I thought this would be a good, testing ground for it. And I've been implementing it, and this is just on our backend admin interface. It's right now, it's really simple. There's two pages that I'm working on. There's the users, the list view, you know, the index view, and then the users show view, right? Actually viewing the user's account.
Mm-hmm.
Bucky just hit my Morse code key. He's trying to send me a message.
Boop, 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 boop. It says, feed me.
Clean my litter box. And man, where to even begin with this, man? I just planned from the beginning to be like, okay, let's see what I can do with live view without getting crazy and without having too high expectations. You know, this obviously is not going to be full view component style front page or, you know, single page application. Just want some basic CRUD, basic things, some forms where you can edit things, and just see how far I can get off of what, you know, I'm on version 1.1 or 0.1.1, I think, right now. I think they're up to 0.2 now.
Yeah, 0.2. I just saw that today, actually, 0.2.
Yeah, so I'll have to update, because I know there's already been a lot of fixes and changes. Man, it's initial thoughts are I'm totally sold on this as a concept.
Oh, snap.
I feel confident using it. It does what it says it does. It's fast, it's surprisingly snappy. Now, of course, I'm running it on my database is local to my client, right? I'm running on localhost, so mm-hmm. It's going to be snappier than in production. I haven't actually tried it on the net yet, although we've done it with the DNC website, you know, up on GigaElixir, and that was like, seemed totally fine, right?
Right.
So I don't think latency is going to be an issue. So here's the thing. I kept sending these videos because I kept getting excited every time I would add some new, like, quick filtering or edit form or whatever. I'll send you a little video and show it off. And that feels cool. And you kept asking if I felt productive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't actually feel more productive. So this is kind of a weird thing to qualify, because when do I feel productive? I feel productive when I'm sort of in one spot. If I'm just in the front end writing peer review components, I feel really, really, really freaking productive.
Okay.
If I'm just on the back end writing API stuff, I feel really productive. It's where those two things meet, and you got to do a lot of jumping back and forth, a lot of reconciling APIs and state between the server and the client, then things start to drag mentally, right, and time-wise.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that, but that makes complete sense.
Yeah, because you've got these two different contexts, and you've got this boundary between them, context in the conceptual sense, and keeping that all in the air, plus you're juggling languages too, which is a big context switching.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like I was getting any work done faster. What I felt like was that I was getting interactivity, but it wasn't for free, right? You still have to put in a little bit of effort to get a little bit of extra pizzazz out of it. And that's what it felt like. It felt like that the extra time spent on sort of building these components separate from regular controller was pretty minimal. And the interface, you know, the gain that the experience gets is a little bit more than minimal, but it's not a game changer like a full JavaScript client side framework would be. And it also doesn't change the fact that you have to, it's just plain old web development crud when it gets down to it, right? You still have to do updates. You still have to handle errors, validation errors, and change sets, and keep in some state in sync. You still have to worry about preloads. You still have to worry about ecto and context. You still have to like do all that stuff. It's just you get this little extra bit of polish in your application.
Right. Okay. And so it seems to me also when in thinking about that little bit of extra polish in your application, it's that you can get farther with the tool that you have without having to reach for a different tool.
Yeah. And that was really the biggest takeaway for me was at the end of the day, like literally at the end of the day, right? You check in your code and you're like, oh man, I don't have to worry about JavaScript dependencies. So an entire tree of package.json files that could go out of date.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about deploying a separate JavaScript application or compiling it or using Webpack or anything. I mean, you do have to do Webpack in your Phoenix app for the client code, but it's very, very small surface area there. And I don't have to worry about deploying it and keeping two code bases up to date and everything. It's literally, it's all Elixir, right? I mean, I didn't write any JavaScript except turning on the socket, right? That literally copy and paste out of the README. And that was all the JavaScript I've written. And that, I think, is going to be the biggest boon for this, is the fact that you don't have to worry about what happens when you come back in a year and like have to make a change to this. It's already there. You know that the underlying technology hasn't changed. You know, like, you don't have to worry about all these extra stuff that's changed because there's so much churn in the JavaScript ecosystem and the frameworks and security and NPM and like all that stuff is just gone out of your mind. And that is worth a lot, turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously LiveView could change, but that's one major dependency and not a bunch of little major dependencies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
An interesting thing that you said, I'm trying to keep this. I'm really struggling on this hot Friday. I said it was hot. I'm going to keep complaining about it. So like one thing you mentioned specifically was like you still have to worry about ecto. You still have to worry about change sets. You still have to worry about handling errors. Now, when I'm working on client, like specifically JS-based apps and working with an API, there's a whole level of thought that has to go into, unless you're subscribing to like JSON API or something like that, there's a whole level of thought that has to go into like what does the shape of my errors look like? How do I communicate those to my client? What does my client do with that? And even with GraphQL, like there's still work that you have to do there to make the translation happen on both sides of the servers, right? Both sides of the context, like you said. And it seems to me like the front end here in this case, like Phoenix has the HTML template helpers that you can use that already have that stuff worked out for you. So in the same way that you're getting farther with the tool without having to reach for a different tool, it seems like it's gaining even more ground in that area for me, as you're kind of talking about these sort of little things that aren't necessarily little in my mind when I have to like approach them.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is that you talked about like that surface area of your API and the shape of it and defining it. And for GraphQL, right, you have a query, and then you have to define the types for it, and you have to define the resolvers, and you have to know what the shape of the data is. That's a good way to think about it. With LiveView though, there is that boundary doesn't exist. Like the API is your application code, mm-hmm. your context you've already written. And you don't have to pass state back and forth, because the state lives in the LiveView server itself. The state can be whatever shape you want it to be. It can be any Erlang term.
Right.
So it could be a map, it could be a struct, it could be a tuple, it could be a list, like whatever you want. Like you can actually use, you know, just like a gen server, an agent, or ETFs, or whatever.
Yeah.
That is the state of your thing, and the interface is just really the interface is events that are emitted by the browser to your application, right? There's this event handler. There's some URL parameters you can handle that too, but that's. It's basically a one-way interface. Those events get fired and you re-render and that gets pushed to the client. But you don't have to, the shape of your state doesn't matter. It's internal, it's private. It's whatever you need it to be for that particular live view.
Yeah, so when I first started digging into that stuff specifically and thinking about it, in my mind, it reminded me very much, and maybe this is because at the conference you were talking about state and view at the same time, so it burned it into my mind. But in thinking about that, how you said your interface is the shape of your data that you have, which can be whatever you make it, and you communicate via events. That's really a lot like Vue version 1 for me, because that's how I wrote Vue quite a bit. Like, you have your data method that can hold whatever shape of data you put into it, and then you can have components talk to each other by broadcasting and dispatching events. And it worked, it worked really well. Obviously, like version 2, like Vue 2, has gone a little bit different direction. It's still great. I still like it. But there was this complexity in my mind when I was approaching looking at LiveView and how to structure this stuff. And then I had that epiphany. I think I tweeted it a couple of weeks ago. I was like, oh, LiveView states, just like, it's kind of like Vuex. You have data that you put in kind of one place, and then you have events that you can emit, which are akin to maybe actions that you can dispatch, right? So the front end, when something happens in the DOM, it just dispatches an event through the socket. The live view, you pattern match on that and you do what you need to and you send the information back. And that's it. That's the whole thing. So I don't know necessarily why maybe there was this initial perceived complexity in my mind, but now, like, as you're just explaining it, I'm thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, it's actually like pretty simple. It like distills a lot of things into a couple of simple mechanics that are easy to work with.
And this is also great. So if application crashes, especially in Vue, it can Vue exceptions can like bring your whole application down, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing just blows up. If you have an exception in your live view code on the server, the process just crashes and the thing restarts and remounts with the initial state.
Right.
So literally, like, I'll be doing something on the page and I'll cause some error, and just that one component on the page just updates again. It reloads back to its initial state. The whole rest of the page is still there, totally fine.
And this goes
that one thing just crashes and reloads.
And it goes back to exactly the point that we were making earlier, is that you could do that or similar things with Vue, like with your error boundaries and stuff. You could wrap a component with an error boundary that would catch errors inside of it, but you still have to do that. You have to be the one to decide where the boundary goes, and you have to be the one to put the error boundary there and handle that situation. Whereas LiveView, it just sort of handles it for you.
Well, yeah, it handles it by crashing.
Handles it by crashing, which is the mantra, right? Let it crash. But yeah, it's interesting. So has there been any like pain points or things that you're running into so far?
Yeah, so obviously I've talked about the good things. We can get into a little more of the nitty-gritty about that stuff. So LiveView modules themselves. So in the way this thing is built, the library is built, is you have a LiveView module, which I should just probably put them in a different folder at this point, but they live in your views folder of your Phoenix application. And man, they can get to be big. You know, it's basically just like your view components, right? There's a lot of stateful logic in there, which is what they're for, but they're still calling it live view. It's still this view component, but there's a lot of stuff in there that's not just about rendering the view, right? It's handling events. You know, it's everything that a sort of controller would do. So you end up with this kind of hybrid view controllers. I don't want to use that because that's like a iOS, macOS development thing. But I don't even know. There's got to be some word for it. But it's this weird space that it occupies both the rendering of the view. I mean, the template is kind of the rendering of the view, but there's a lot of coupling there in terms of logic and the view itself. I mean, thinking of live view like just a pure view is not correct. It's more of a, I don't know, component, controller, presenter. It's not even really a presenter though. I'm not sure, but it occupies that space.
It does feel a lot like a view controller to me now that I think about it. Talking about this makes me think of the, I don't know how many years ago that would have been, but the term like NV star, you know, all the different paradigms we had for like model view controller, view star, I'll have to put it the link, but you know, we had like different backbone apps. We had Ember apps at that point. We had Angular apps going on. There was lots of different paradigms floating around.
We need a regular expression to match on them all.
Yeah, basically. And now it's, you know, Vue and React and Angular, like really, there's smaller ones, but the paradigms are sort of pretty similar these days, right? But yeah, to me, it seems like the live view modules themselves especially feel like view controllers to me, because it has sort of the presentational stuff in it sometimes, especially if you don't have the template put into another file. If you're using the live view sigil, the template's right in there. And then you have, you know, you're responding to events and things, and then you can have state management stuff in there if that doesn't belong in a context, you know? So you have some sort of piping and glue happening sometimes there too.
And you're also going to be touching your repository as well, your data store, because as I found out, when you're the initial quote unquote, the session parameter that gets passed to your view when it boots up, when it mounts, that's actually like, you're supposed to keep that really small, I guess, because it's actually serialized and persisted in actual HTML as like a data attribute.
Right. Yeah. It's signed and then put on the, I think it's on the controller or the container, right? The container of the live view.
Yeah, exactly. Which makes sense, because when you navigate to and from, it needs to some initial state to mount with. And so that was another thing I ran into. I accidentally was just like, I was calling, you know, initializing the session from the controller to do the rendering. And I just threw my whole user struct into it because it was, you know, modifying the user. Yeah, don't do that. The session thing is like 5 kilobytes long.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's this huge thing. Just throw in the user ID. And then when the thing mounts, rehydrate it from the database with that user ID.
So sort of treating it like active job or whatever before there, because I remember when I was working with, when I started first learning about job stuff with Rails, people were like, put the ID and only the ID in the job, you know, for things like, you know, what happens if the data changes before the job is running. If you put the whole struct in there, the whole data object in there, then you're going to be operating on out of date data and stuff like that. So
that's still a problem. Like, it's still a race condition there, or, you know, where that could change. Right.
Right.
So I was thinking of it more of like, if I think of the session of the live view as like a user session in regular web app land, those, you always want to keep those small, right? Because they're cookies and stuff. So
yeah,
think of it like a cookie, and then you'll be on the right track. So where was I going with that? That was another thing where I have this user's admin page, right? And I have each sort of, there's 5 live views on it right now. And each of them is just a sort of separate form for modifying different parts of their profile. Some of it's, you know, like their address, admin notes, membership details, whatever, sign-in details. Each one of those things is separate and mounts separately and has to hit the database when it mounts. This is obviously not really going to be a huge performance issue. This is just a back end. I don't care. It never gets used. It's not going to be a bottleneck. But yeah, I really am, you know, loading the user five times for one page. Six, actually, because I have to also render the main page that contains it. So, and, you know, this could be easily fixed by just making the whole page a live view and then breaking it up into these little subcomponents somehow. I haven't quite figured that out. Now, I know you can have live views within live views, but so that's something you need to think about. Like, these are long-lived processes. You want to keep track of memory. You got to think about your database and your preloads and all that stuff, because they're all basically separate requests. Sort of like the, you know, the problems you used to have with before you're using GraphQL, where you had all these requests coming in for different resources and you had to authenticate each one and so on.
Right. Right. Yeah. That, I hadn't really thought about that yet either. That's, so how are you mitigating that?
I'm not right now. Okay. I'm just saying it's fine. I'll figure it out at some point. I'm sure there's better patterns for doing this sort of thing, but, just something I noticed.
Gotcha. Man, there's just so many building apps is a lot of work. There's a lot of stuff to have to know about.
Yeah. And I mean, I ran into one little like bug, an exception. Like, it was a pretty standard form control and it wasn't working properly. So I messaged Chris. Chris has been in the Elixir Slack in the live view channel, very active over the past couple weeks. And I was like, hey, what about this? He's like, oh, it's already on master.
Nice.
I already fixed it on master. So I was like, okay, sweet. So they're obviously working on it. Like you said, they got 0.2 out now, which I gotta pull down. And still adding lots of features and talking about different things. And like, I'm still wrapping my head around how to deal with things like hooks and keeping sort of track of state and more complicated forms and interactions and stuff. Finding that line where live view starts to fall apart, or maybe you have to resort to something a little more complicated on the client. You know, I was talking about this with you, where it's like, you know, standard HTML form controls are pretty bare bones and kind of suck, especially when you get into like selects and multi-selects. Mm-hmm. They're very limited in what they can do. And I was almost at a point where I needed to start using some kind of more powerful select control that maybe uses a hidden field underneath or something like that. And I eventually just got around it by just making a better UI in LiveView with separate sort of add and remove controls. And you know what? It works great. Bucky, stop hitting the Morse code key. Oh my God.
So you're talking about some sort of like tagging select, and you just, instead of building a tagging select where you can add things on the fly, right? That's essentially what you're talking about, a tagging select?
Yeah, basically a many-to-many where you've got a user and they you have to give them different permission groups or something like that.
Right, yeah. I don't know why I always try to fall back to using a tagging select when it's not even the greatest experience for users.
Yeah, because you have to already know what the thing is called before you start typing it in.
Yeah, you have filtering, but also it can be just confusing, especially if you have users that aren't necessarily super tech savvy. Some of the, you know, depending, there, a lot of them are implemented, like the functionality and searching and filtering and stuff and adding is like implemented a little bit differently. I guess these days they're a little better, like view multi-select is pretty solid, but I remember early on when we were first starting to pull stores into DK, we were using tagging selects for assigning products to rooms categories and assigning materials and colors. And that was one of the things that frequently came up, where like people were like, how do I use this tagging select thing? How do I make one? You know, they don't know that if they start typing and by the time they're finished typing what they want, if it doesn't exist, they can then hit enter to create it, or hit down, there's like a little message, it might say like add whatever, you know. It's not obvious to them, oh, I have to type the full thing out to be able to add this thing.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you have to even know to do that, to how to interact with it before you can even see the results of that.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the stuff that you were showing me looked pretty nice, and I honestly, I had no clue that that was the result of avoiding a tagging select or multi-select setup. To me, I was like, oh, that's a neat little UI, and it looks friendly to me. It didn't seem like there was a lot of, I feel like a lot of these, especially with these tagging setups with the JavaScript, there's a lot of magic that's trying to happen or be done for people. And the UI you were showing me was just pretty dead simple. Click edit, click a plus button, a new text input shows up, you type in and click save, and it's added to a list.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I also find that if you have any kind of autocomplete library, it usually does 90% of what you need it to do. And every library does a different 90% of what you need it to do.
Yeah.
It frustrates me.
Yeah. So that's really interesting for me to think about, because I've been slowly rebuilding BThink because I use it all the time still, and using LiveView just because I wanted to. And right now it's a separate Nuxt app and an API, and so I'm just kind of unifying them because it's so simple. It doesn't need to be two apps to maintain. I was thinking about what about like date time selects? You basically kind of have to reach out to JavaScript to do that kind of stuff. But maybe there's some sort of UI where I can make it easy to type in, where I don't have to reach out to one of the libraries. I can't remember what the one I was using was called, but it's kind of the same thing. Like if someone's looking at a calendar API, it's probably, or a calendar component, it's probably at least a little different from the last one they were looking at.
Yeah, it got so bad where I was actually started looking at jQuery libraries,
yeah.
Right? Like, oh, just throw this thing in here and you get this magic form control. And like, that's kind of where we're at, because it's literally, it's the same problem. It's just a new world.
Yeah, I guess what's neat about LiveView though is that you don't have to reach out to jQuery to be able to say like click on an edit button and have the form repaint itself, and now it's an edit form instead of a list view item or something like that.
Oh yeah, that was the bad old days of RHR client version 1, where it was literally like a 7,000 line jQuery spaghetti code. Yeah. Where
I had to just before I found Vue, I had to build a calendar component in a Rails app with jQuery.
Oh boy. Like you built the control yourself?
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah. Yep.
You know better now.
Yeah. Do you know how much code was written to just update the DOM correctly?
Oh boy. I can't even imagine.
It was a nightmare. You remember the days of like storing data and data attributes on DOM elements and then pulling that out, turning it back into JSON?
So that's also back. That's also back.
Is it?
Yeah. So when you can throw these like Phoenix, PHX, dash, whatever attributes on tags to do things.
Yeah.
But I also found myself, I didn't have to do it yet, but I almost put myself in a corner where I had to like throw, basically you can register hooks with the LiveView client. So you pass this static sort of hooks object that has a couple of callback handlers for different events in the Phoenix LiveView lifecycle. But it's a static thing. You can't parameterize it. It's just an object with functions, and you can't really pass any params to the functions at all.
Hmm.
So how do you, if you want to do something that has a parameter, you got to friggin' throw a data attribute on the target element. And when that hook gets called, you just do this.l.dataset.whatever to pull that attribute back out.
Right. I remember seeing this at the keynote. That's right.
Yeah, and like again, I didn't have to do it. I ended up, but like that's a tool you can reach for, and it's totally a thing. And I was talking with Chris about it. I was like, well, can we parameterize the hooks? He's like, well, we can't do that for some reason that went over my head. Something about the hooks being stateful across the connection or something. I don't know. And so that's back, and it's still cool. And that's how Stimulus.js works.
Oh, really?
As well is they you can do, you know, they sort of Stimulus treats the DOM as a source of truth for the state. And so the only way to store state in the DOM is to use data tags.
Right.
Data attributes.
Yeah, I suppose it's easier to treat the DOM as a source of truth because it's a physical thing that's there and is rendered. And doing it the opposite way, it gets really difficult in having to constantly do that yourself unless you're using VDOM or something, right? I guess I don't know enough about it really know.
Yeah, so that was one of the other like big takeaways with LiveView. I mentioned the other benefits. The really nicest thing is that, as you mentioned, the DOM is a source of truth. And guess what? With LiveView, you're rendering on the server, so you know that what you're rendering is the truth. There's no state that could possibly get out of sync, unless, I don't know, your database blows up or something.
Hmm.
Someone trips over a Postgres cord while your transaction is happening. I don't know. But like,
right.
If you see a view, you know it's actually there. And the user never has to think about this, right? They assume if they can see it as true, which we all know everything is in the back is asynchronous, and it's never actually true for a while, especially if it's a scheduled task or whatever. But if it's rendered, it's actually there. It's actually persisted, and you know the state is correct. And that is like not having to worry about, am I looking at something that's wrong? Are my eyes deceiving me? That can happen so easily with the, you know, when you've got this boundary between your application, your persistence layer, and what's being presented. And that boundary is essentially gone because, again, you're rendering the truth. that is a huge, again, just mental overhead.
Right.
Gone.
Man, I'm really excited to see where this goes for you.
Yeah.
See what the thing looks like and the lessons you learn along the way. I'm living vicariously because as much as I want to add live view into something that we're doing here, I don't think it would make sense for us because our stuff is all JavaScript right now anyway. We don't really have any server rendered stuff. So I could make smaller Phoenix apps for different domains like the DK dashboard or the store admin or whatever, but I don't know that it makes sense to do that at this point. So I'm sort of living vicariously through you.
I'll just keep sending you little videos in Discord.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have two more quick things that I have to share with because I'm really kind of proud of them.
Okay.
I discovered them. Again, I've only been doing this for a few days, so I'm still kind of working out the patterns, but there's two cool sort of patterns that emerged for me. The first one was using schemaless embedded schemas in Ecto within the live view. So I've got a users list here. So it just lists all the users in the application. And there's a search form at the top, like filtering. You can search by, you know, username or email address. And then there's a couple of dropdowns so you can filter by, you know, whether the account is active or trash or overdue, what services they're subscribed to, and so on. Which is just plain old view filtering. And of course, it's live view. So as you change the form, the list updates in real time. There's no debouncing because it's not in there yet.
Right.
It might be in point 2, actually. I don't know. Hope it is. But it's literally like every keystroke, it's querying the database, which is cool. But you've got this form and the form could grow and become more complex. You know, I want to add more filters over time. Right now, there's only 3, but I want to add ordering and filtering and whatever. So I just represented the form as a quote unquote form object using an embedded schema right in the live view. So I just define the module in live view, use Ecto things. I can use change set validations. The form is actually rendered using the change set for this embedded schema.
Interesting.
And, you know, I can do validations to, you know, nullify. So it automatically like nullifies, you know, empty strings. So I don't have to filter on that.
Mm.
And then I reduce over that struct using the plain old, you know, reduce pattern for building up Ecto queries.
I like that.
We've used before for params. Yeah. And it's like you get the structured way to represent your form data in the database, and you get type checking and all this other niceties that we already know about and are using. So that's pretty cool. I'm definitely going to reuse that.
You should put that in a gist so we can share that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I will do that. Definitely. And the other cool thing I started doing was I made like a super, super generic live view. It just called like a CRUD live view that has a concept of just a plain old like Rails resource, you know, edit, update, delete, adding and removing associated records. And it's everything in it is parameterized by whatever the type is. So like I've got this user view, but I've got a bunch of different components in it that have do different things, but they're all actually backed by the same live view logic. It's just parameters that tell it which models are being updated or whatever. And I'll be able to reuse this for a bunch of the backend stuff because it's so simple and samey. And the benefit is, you know, I don't have to write the code once. I get all the reuse. But the downside is that it adds a lot of friction if you want to do anything else. Like you kind of code yourself into a corner because now everything's going to look and feel the same when in reality, maybe you want to add a little extra something here and there, and suddenly the whole thing just falls down because you can't reuse it.
Right.
There might be some fun metaprogramming you could do there, but I don't want to go down that route.
So it's certainly an interesting idea, though.
Yeah, because the fact is the live view itself is literally the same module behind the scenes, but just the template, literally the view template itself, the leaks file, live EX, is the only thing that's different.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's fun. I'll put some gists and maybe some little videos in here.
Yeah, I'd love to see those again anyway, and the gist too. That's cool stuff. That's really cool stuff.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. But like I said, this is going to be an ongoing thing. I got to get back into Electron world next week.
Fun. I'm about to be in Vue world for a couple of days, so preparing my
Vue world is nice.
Preparing my body. Yeah, it's not bad. I've been building an affiliate program system, so the back end is like done. There's no UI for it because we basically just have some partnerships that we worked on, and to be able to track how much money we owe them, we really just need an affiliate system. And the basic moving pieces did in a half a day on the back end, right? It's just basic Ecto structs and a couple of tables. And you know, then the front end is like the cookie passing and all that stuff. So that's what I'm going to be working on next.
Yeah, a lot of handshaking and...
Yeah, handshaking, and a lot of research went into that, like looking at different programs, like how people run it, and then deciding which trade-offs to make was the other thing too. So like scheduling a call and being like, okay, we could do this, we could do that. Here are the trade-offs, you know? So for example, choosing on whether, if you wanted to do the simplest route, you could have an order, a single order, be associated with only a single affiliate. Because if it's associated with more than one affiliate, how do you know whose products belongs to which? You could do affiliates on product row level, but that's more work than I'm willing to bite off right now. So one of the trade-offs I saw people were making, different companies were making, are you either have to choose to honor the first refer or the last refer. So some people, if you were on refer A and you hit DK, and then you went back and you were on refer B and you went back to DK, some people either A, keep refer A's cookie, or B, overwrite refer A's with refer B's cookie, for example. Right?
My God. Like you're literally writing business logic that decides
who gets money,
whether or not someone gets money.
So there's a lot of trade-offs to make that.
As long as you're upfront about it.
As long as you're upfront about it, exactly. And then, as like you said, as long as you spell it out and it's clear how that works. Or, you know, you could actually make it on a store basis or whatever, you know. I don't know. But basically right now we're lucky that we don't have cross-pollination. So integration A, their users aren't using integration B's application and vice versa. It's not like Trendsetter A, right, might have users that might also look at Trendsetter B's affiliate stuff. That's not a thing we have to deal with right now. So
that's true.
Yeah.
You know, you said to me one time how every application grows until it develops chat.
Yep.
I feel that way with affiliate programs as well. Like every online store grows until it has an affiliate system or referral system.
Affiliates and chats. We got both now. So
you're done.
We got both.
Pack it in.
Phone it in. Let the Instagram people take over now and make money.
The influencers?
Yeah. The Instagrams. That's what I call them. But
is that like the YouTubes? The Facebook?
The YouTubes, the YouTabs. The social networkers that social network on social networks I don't know exist yet. But yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to seeing how this live view stuff works out. And again, I'll be living vicariously through that.
Yeah, we'll see how much time I can actually spend on it.
Yeah.
You know, it feels wrong when it's actually fun to do it, so I should probably do some real work instead.
Yeah. Well, if anyone has feedback on live view or interested in seeing those things, you should definitely hit us up because we like talking about live view. Or you can join us in the Elixir Slack, even though that's not our Slack. We hang out there too, talking live view. So we just want to hear from all you people that I know you have opinions. We know you guys have opinions, or you all have opinions out there. We just want to hear them.
You can send us your opinions. Sean's home address. Twitter for the show is DNC Show. Sean is Sean Washbot. And I am Shrockwell.
And as always, we're going to be putting these show notes on dnc.show. They'll be available there. And I know I'm myself going to go back to dnc.show and look at the gist that Rockwell links to. So I think you should do that too.
We'll also post them over on spectrum.chat, where we can have discussions with us and come say hi and discuss live
views. as always, thanks to that felt like an Anthony Fantano transition there. But as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out there and working with us. You guys are awesome.
Archer does that a lot too.
Really?
Like every transition in their show is one sentence leading to the other between scenes.
Gotcha.
It's really distracting, honestly.
Yeah.
This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson.
Ba-da-ba-ba. Well, I'm going to go outside because it's hot in here.
Go walk your new dog.
Yeah, I need to do that.
And a poor pup.
He's hanging out.
What's his name? Watson? Is that actually a name?
Yeah.
Oh, Watson.
I was pushing work
That's awesome.
For Wesley Crusher, but he's half pit bull.
Watson.
And we felt like having Crusher in the name of a pit bull pup around these parts especially would be not looked upon in good graces.
Yeah, he's really good at crushing treats with his jaws.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a pit bull lad mix, so doesn't look...
Is Watson the Sherlock Watson?
Yeah.
Or the IBM Watson?
Sherlock Watson, because IBM Watson blows up my logs occasionally.
Really?
The server logs. Yeah, I've noticed it a couple of times.
Huh.
I don't know what they're doing, but they're doing something.
It's probably self-aware and No one knows what it's doing.
It's probably shopping for itself. I could really use a new credenza in server room A.
I love it. I like the idea of that, like in the Matrix, like the two old weather chairs in like the stark white room.
Right.
All right. Goodbye for real.
See ya.